From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Attorney Frederick A.O. Schwartz Jr. explores why the U.S. government is growing more secretive and what we can do about it in a new book. Mental health expert Luis Sias looks at the psychological impact of immigration detention and deportation on children. And actress and author Mario Hemingway shares a pair of books aimed at increasing mental health awareness. But first, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, a self-described Democratic socialist, is running for president. His bid against Hillary Clinton, the front-runner for the Democratic nomination, is seen as quixotic by some. But Sanders bristles at the notion that he's in the race merely to force Clinton's agenda further to the left.
We're in this race to win. But it's not a question. But you got to understand. I ask people to understand my history. You are looking at a guy, undisputably, who has the most unusual political history of anybody in the United States Congress. I've run, it's not only that I'm the longest serving independent in the history of the Congress, I've run for statewide office, I got 1% of the vote. I don't know if I should be proud of that, but my last election I got 71% of the vote. The point is, that's not the right question. The question is, if you raise the issues that are on the hearts and minds of the American people, if you try to put together a movement which says we have got to stand together as a people and say that this capital, this beautiful capital, our country belongs to all of us and not the billionaire class, that's not raising an issue. That is winning elections. That's where the American people are.
Senator Sanders, good to have you back on this program, sir.
Good to be with you, Thomas.
Let me start by asking the all-important question that you were just talking about in that clip from your press conference announcing your bid. What is the platform? What are you running on?
The heart of the platform is that despite an explosion of technology and worker productivity, for the last 40 years, Tavis, the middle class of this country has been disappearing. Millions of people are working longer hours for low wages. We have 45 million people who are living in poverty, and the gap between the very, very rich and everybody else is growing wider. We cannot have a sustainable economy when 99% of all new income generated today goes to the top 1%, where you have the top goes to the top 1%, and where you have the top 0.1% just reaping almost all of the financial benefits of this economy. That is just not sustainable. It is not moral. It is not American.
Is it just about income inequality, or is it also centered about economic immobility?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that bothers me, Tavis, is that when we read about unemployment, for example, they talk about the official unemployment rate at 5.5%. Real unemployment's 11%. Youth unemployment, 17%. African-American youth unemployment, literally off the charts. So what we need to do is to create millions of decent-paying jobs in this country. In my view, the fastest way we do that is rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. We need to make college affordable. You have countries like Germany, Denmark, Scandinavia in general that provide free college tuition for their students. We should be doing exactly the same. At a time of massive income and wealth inequality, you know what? We are going to have to ask the billionaire class and the wealthiest people in this country to start paying their fair share of taxes. We have to end these loopholes that allow corporate America to stash their money in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and other tax havens. So there's a lot to be done, but essentially, we need a mass movement of people who say enough is enough, that this great country of ours belongs to all of us and not to a handful of billionaires who, by the way, not only economically have enormous power, but as a result of Citizens United Supreme Court decision, now can own the political process. How many people are comfortable with the Koch brothers putting almost $1 billion into electing the candidates of their choice? That is undermining American democracy. Citizens United has got to be overturned. And then, of course, you got climate change and the need to transform our energy system. Those are a few of the issues, Tavis.
I think your message about poverty and income inequality and economic immobility is a message that will resonate. But to your point, to create that mass movement, one has to get his message out. And this won't surprise you to know that in this country, to get your message out, it requires money. How will you raise the money?
That's a great question, Tavis. And it's something, you know, I was thinking about running for many, many months, and I was saying three things, actually. Number one, could we raise the money to run a winning campaign? Could we build a grassroots movement? And would we get coverage from the corporate media? Those were the three impediments to running.
Mm-hmm.
What we did is we, in fact, announced my candidacy, and in a week and a half, Tavis, we have gotten contributions now from some 90,000 Americans, averaging somewhere around $43 a piece. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, I think we can raise nowhere near what my opponents will raise, that's for sure. But I think we can raise the kind of money that we need to run a strong and winning campaign. We have also had some 200,000 people have gone to BernieSanders.com to sign up, in a sense, to be part of the campaign. So we're making progress in that direction as well. I think the people want to see real action in transforming our economy. They want to participate in the political process, and we're doing our best to make that happen.
To that third point that you had to figure out whether or not you would be treated fairly, do you think now, going forward, that you're going to get the kind of attention that corporate media gives Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush and others?
Well, I doubt that we'll get that kind of attention, but so far it is, to be honest with you, pretty good. But the issue here is, as a nation, will the corporate media allow a serious discussion on serious issues rather than looking at politics as a baseball game or a soap opera? You know, this is not the Yankees versus the Red Sox. This is the future of America and what happens to tens of millions of our people. Can we have the kind of debate that we need as to why the rich are getting much richer while everybody else is getting poorer? Why we are not doing enough to deal with a planetary crisis of climate change? Why we have got to overturn Citizens United so that billionaires cannot elect the candidates of their choice? Very serious issues that need serious discussion, and I will do everything that I can to force those types of discussions.
It's one thing to ask Senator Sanders how you'll be treated or maltreated by the corporate media. It's another question to ask how you think you'll be treated by the Democratic Party. You've been an independent for a long time, the longest serving independent in the history of Congress, and yet you decided to run as a Democrat. So let me ask two questions, I guess. One, why run for the Democratic nomination and not as an independent? Question one. And question two, given that you've been an independent for so long, how do you expect to be treated by the person that many regard as the presumptive Democratic nominee, Mrs. Clinton, given her deep and longstanding ties to the Democratic Party?
All right, first of all, let me ask you the second question first. It's okay. Absolutely true. I am an independent, was elected as an independent, longest-serving independent in congressional history, but also I have functioned within the Democratic caucus from the first day that I was elected to Congress 25 years ago. So working with Democrats is what I do. Mm-hmm. I am now the ranking member of the Budget Committee appointed by the Democratic leadership. I was former chairman of the Senate Veterans Committee appointed by the leadership and my colleagues in the Democratic caucus. So working with Democrats is not anything new to me. That's what I have done for 25 years. In terms of your first question, it's a good question, and I thought long and hard about it. The problem is, essentially, that if you were to run as an independent outside of the two-party system, it would take an enormous amount of time and energy and money just to get on the ballot, and the likelihood is you couldn't even get on the ballot in 50 states in this country. So it seemed to me that if we wanted to be in the mix, if we wanted to run a campaign which would have the opportunity to debate my leading opponents, if we wanted to get media attention, the only path was working within the Democratic primary process, and that's what I'm going to do.
And yet part of your indictment over the years has been, quite frankly, of the two-party system, that yeah. Washington is bought and bossed by big money and big business, and it matters not which party you are a part of.
Well, let me just say that, you know, that is true. But I think clearly right now, what you have is a Republican Party which has become moving away from being a moderate conservative party to a kind of a right-wing extremist party, mm-hmm. heavily influenced by the Koch brothers. Are the Democrats as a party standing up and fighting for the working class of this country as strong as they should be? Absolutely not. Are there great members in the Senate who are Democrats who are fighting? There are. So, you know, it would be wrong to equate both parties in the same language. But I think there's no question that Democrats have mm-hmm. got to be a lot stronger and tougher in standing up to big money.
I know that last week you sent a very strong letter to President Obama asking him encouraging him not to take that meeting with Nike. Obviously, he didn't listen. He went to Oregon, had the meeting with Nike anyway, and while he was there, I don't know that he called you by name specifically, but he certainly referenced critics like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren out of Massachusetts, who he said were just dead wrong. On this issue, you all are just dead wrong. But then he went a step further and did something that I'm not sure I've heard the president ever do regarding members of his own party, and that is to accuse Senator Warren of playing politics with the issue of being opposed to this trade deal. How did you read those remarks by the president?
Well, look, you know, I like President Obama very much. I voted for him. I campaigned for him. He's wrong. He thinks we're wrong, but I'm quite sure he is wrong. Where we're at, Tavis, is if you look at why the American middle class is disappearing, one of the reasons is that since 2001, we've lost almost 60,000 factories in this country and millions of decent-paying jobs. And furthermore, because corporations are shutting down here and moving to China and Vietnam and other low-wage countries, there's an enormous pressure, downward pressure on wages in America to make American workers more competitive with Chinese workers. I think the evidence is overwhelming that NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China have failed, and that this is a continuation of failed policies. I do not believe, unlike the president, I guess, that American workers should have to compete against people in Vietnam who make 56 cents an hour, cannot express their views openly, cannot be critical of their government, cannot form trade unions. That, to me, is not a level playing field.
Senator Sanders, good to have you on this program so many times in the past, and as your campaign continues to go forward, we look forward to having you back on again. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you, Tavis.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. There was a time, according to attorney Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr., that the American government kept secrets to protect the people. Today, Schwartz says, the government keeps secrets to protect itself from the people. He is an expert on the subject. In 1975, he was chief counsel to the U.S. Senate Church Committee, which uncovered the FBI's illegal COINTELPRO operation. Now chief counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, Schwartz explores the growing culture of secrecy in a new text, Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy. Good to have you on this program, Mr. Schwartz.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Let me start by asking how it is that we have been so seduced by government secrecy.
Well, the secrecy is something that people in power use to keep information away from the public. Mm-hmm. But people who generate secrets are seduced themselves by secrecy. And I'll give you one example mm-hmm. of that. Right, every year right now, 100 million documents are stamped classified. Mm-hmm. If you're in the government and you want someone to pay attention to whatever you write, you have to classify it. You think you have to classify it and move it to top secret, or otherwise nobody will pay any attention to it. Mm. And there are other ways in which secrecy is seductive, but it makes people feel powerful when they use it. Mm-hmm. And so that's among the reasons for it.
I understand the strategy, I suspect, that you've just laid out for those who want what they write to be paid attention to. I get it strategically, but what price does the American public pay for that?
Well, we pay a terrible price because by the way, some secrecy is legitimate.
Sure, sure.
We have to recognize that. Right. But we pay a terrible price by excessive secrecy. Most basically, it deprives the American public of what is their birthright, mm-hmm. which is to be informed about what their government is doing and about the character of their leaders. And if you hide things, you don't get informed, yeah. So you can't vote clearly. You don't know enough about the character of your leaders.
I'm not naive in asking this, but why has this problem gotten worse and worse with each successive presidential administration?
Well, I don't know that it's worse with each successive, but yeah. It's definitely worse than what was the historical tradition right. In the United States. Fear is important. fear of danger, and that's one of the reasons that drives secrecy. And, of course, again, some secrecy is legitimate, but not nearly as much as there is.
Yeah. I wouldn't debate you because, one, you're the expert, but, number two, I don't have the data to back this up. But something in my mind, as a citizen and one who is relatively informed and watches this, would take that. I would take that fight with you about whether or not it's gotten worse with each presidential administration. And my argument, without the data in front of me, would essentially be it's gotten worse because every president wants to pull more and more power to his side.
Well, it's one of the reasons why it's very typical for a president before they become president to praise openness, and then after they become president to bow toward secrecy, bend toward secrecy. And that happens to all presidents, and it is because of the power. Another reason is the people who work for the CIA and the NSA and the FBI are important to the country, and a president comes into office and he suddenly realizes these people are very important, and much of their work is good, not all of it, but much is good. So he or someday she don't want to punch in the belly of the CIA or the NSA on things those agencies care deeply about. That's, I think, another reason why when someone comes into office, they bend more toward secrecy than they had before.
But that's why I believe that whether it's Republican or Democrat, in the era of social media, in the era of increasing government leaks, you know, no matter what one thinks of Edward Snowden, in the era of Edward Snowden, I would think that more and more administrations into the future are going to be more and more secretive with documentation.
Well, maybe. Yeah. But actually, Obama, while he has certainly moved much more towards secrecy than one thought before he came into office, has done some things that are better than the prior administrations with budgets, for example, with nuclear information. Every president is going to be pushed in that direction. I'm actually optimistic, a little bit optimistic. I don't want to be stupidly optimistic about the future for two reasons. One, it's a bipartisan issue. Just as presidents from both parties have abused secrecy, the Congress from both parties is worried about too much secrecy. We're seeing that right now on the debate about some of the things Snowden revealed. The other reason I'm optimistic for the future, and as again I say, not foolishly optimistic, is that the national security experts themselves are beginning to understand that too much secrecy gets in the way of protecting national security. Too much secrecy makes it harder to do what's the most important thing today to protect the country with information, is to get it out and around to the right people as quickly as possible. And if you have billions of secret documents and an encrusted culture of secrecy, that makes it harder to do the most important thing, which is to get it around.
I get that. And I'm glad you raised that issue, Frederick, of national security.
Fritz, by the way. Even though my name's Frederick, I'm called Fritz.
Okay. I appreciate that. there's another Fritz who endorsed this book.
He did.
Fritz Mondale.
And that's I tease him that the only reason he didn't win the election is because he ran as Walter instead of Fritz.
That's good. I'm glad you raised Fritz, national security, because the one thing that I am tired of hearing, quite frankly, as a taxpayer, is that everything is done in the name of national security. Yeah. How demonized, how bastardized is that phrase, national security?
It's much too loose a phrase, for one thing.
Yeah.
Before President Truman added to the classification in the country, documents used to be allowed to be kept secret for national defense. It's a narrower expression than the vague expression national security. And it's abused all the time. I mean, when Nixon, broke into the Ellsberg psychiatrist's office when he was talking to John Dean, his counsel, and said, "What the hell are we going to do if this gets discovered?" They agreed together, well, we can always say it was due to national security. So it's much, much too loose a term. The Church Committee found as one of its major findings that the looseness of that term contributed to many of the pieces of wrongdoing that we brought out.
What role does the media play in pushing demanding that kind of transparency and not being rolled by Washington in the name of national security or defense.
The media is vital to protecting American democracy. In the first 160 years or so of our country, newspapers, really before there was much television, were absolutely vital to democracy. And Madison, for example, said way back at the beginning of the country that public opinion is the true sovereign in a democracy. Mm-hmm. And to have an opinion in the public, they have to be informed. So newspapers and journalism in general were vital to dispersing information. Now, social media disperses a lot of information. And what journalism, TV, newspapers are really vital for today is discovering information. They're the heart. They're really vital to our democratic system working.
Mm-hmm. This might be a little far afield, but I want to just get your take on it since you're here to have such an interesting, I suspect, response to this, which is what you make of the way we go about gathering these secrets in the world today. I think of the offense that the German chancellor took, as she should have, that we were listening into her phone conversations. Yes. What's your sense after 9/11 of the way we're going about gathering these secrets?
Well, we lost any sense of restraint at all after 9/11. I mean, it was bad before, but after 9/11, I think we really did lose any sense of restraint. And we didn't, the government didn't pay attention to how we can injure this country by doing things like that. I mean, Germany is still a close ally of ours, but it didn't help that she was offended by that. So, and another example would be the Snowden revealed how the Google and Microsoft and all those companies were being used by the government to help them get information. And that's kind of short-sighted on the government's part, because what it's doing is making consumers in the foreign nations and foreign governments want to do more to compete with those powerful and basically important American companies.
You mentioned Daniel Ellsberg earlier in this conversation, and you also mentioned, we both did, Edward Snowden. In this era of increasing government secrecy, how do you suspect that Edward Snowden is going to be regarded 25, 50 years from now?
Well, I think Snowden will be regarded, number one, as a patriot. Mm. It's perfectly clear he acted for patriotic reasons. Mm. And number two, I think he'll be regarded as having been helpful to the country, because almost all of what he put out for debate were things that should have been put out for debate by the presidents before they went down the road that they went down. Mm-hmm. So I think Snowden is going to be regarded as a patriotic person who was helpful to the country.
Do you think that his actions are going to spur others to do the same? And do you think that if, in fact, that is the case, that those who are collecting these and abusing these secrets will be deterred in what they're doing?
It's possible that there'll be some deterrence. Mm-hmm. But the generation of secrets is like a mighty river that flows, and it's pretty hard to stop the river flowing. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing, I think, though, is that it's part of the reason, I think, that many of the very smartest people in the CIA and the NSA and so forth are saying, wait a minute, we've got so much, and it's going to be increasingly easy for people to leak it out. Therefore, we should be smarter and restrict the amount of secrecy that we're developing.
It's a powerful argument for how the hoarding of these secrets end up in the long run damaging our democracy. It's called Democracy in the Dark: The Seduction of Government Secrecy by Frederick Fritz, A.O. Schwartz, Jr. Fritz, good to have you on the program. Thanks for your insights.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Glad to have you here. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. These days, we often apply superlatives to a bit too early and too freely to artists of all stripes, but in the case of B.B. King, the legendary blues musician who passed away this week at the age of 89,
Every word of praise is more than deserved. He rightfully is considered the most influential blues musician of all time, earning the title King of the Blues. We were honored to have him on this program last in 2013 to talk about his remarkable life and career. The King of the Blues, B.B. King, coming up. The King of the Blues is in the house tonight, Riley B. King. Can I just tell you, I've been looking forward to this for, I've been in the broadcast business now for just my 21st year. We've hung out all over the world, in Germany and Europe, all throughout Europe. I've been with you on tour, and we've been all over the country, but never one-on-one on a TV set, so I am delighted.
I'm missing it.
Glad you're finally here. it ain't like you ain't been doing nothing. You're hard to catch up with. Yeah. You'll be 88 later this year.
Yeah, you said it. My birthday is right behind yours.
Yeah, I'm a 13th and you're the
16th.
You're the 16th. Mm-hmm. How you feeling? You looking well?
Tavis, I think I've taken about much of this as I can test.
You look good, though.
Oh, God, he went at it again.
Yeah, I went at it again. I just like to mess with you. I want to start our conversation talking about some things that people might not know about you.
Okay.
We know so much about your music, and I'll get to the music. That's the fun part. But some things that I find fascinating that help make you who you are that your fans and others might not know. In no particular order, you saw a lynching. Many years ago, that impacted you and changed your life in profound ways in the Mississippi Delta. Tell me about the lynching that you saw.
Well, they, I didn't actually see him being lynched, but I saw him being drugged up the streets over to the courthouse. I was in a little town called Lexington, Mississippi. And I think it scared me more than anything else because I was maybe a few years older than he was. So he was a boy, and I was scared after seeing them dragging him up the streets.
How does that impact a child, a black child, growing up in that part of the world at that time?
Well, as I said, it scared me for one thing.
Right.
Secondly, I thought that just as it had happened to that guy, it could happen to me. So I've always liked ladies all my life. I guess it started with my mom. So every time I saw a pretty lady, I thought, she's pretty, like I said. And that's what had happened to this boy.
Yeah.
He was sort of like Emmett Till and what the other one is, another one.
Yeah.
Had the same thing happen.
Yeah. So, yeah, Emmett Till, for those who don't know the story, I think most people do, was accused of whistling at a white woman, and that was his crime, and he was...
They killed him
for that.
Took him out in Blue Lake. Did you know we had a Mississippi lake called Blue Lake?
I did know that.
You did know
that? Yeah, I did know that.
I forget, though. You're
from Mississippi. Yeah, like you, so I know a little bit about that. Not as much as you, but a little bit about that history.
I was just a cotton picker.
Yeah. Since you mentioned your mother and that you have always loved the ladies, I know that to be the case, starting with your mama. Tell me about your mama.
My mother was a very beautiful lady, I thought. And she was very good to me. I guess she died when I was 9 and a half. But if she had lived, I probably wouldn't be trying to play guitar. She wanted me to be known. But as something else, not a guitar player.
Yeah. Known for what?
Anything that's just somebody that
doctor,
would make
lawyer,
the,
politician,
make the
something
world,
like that. Make the world better.
Make the world better.
Yeah. But you've done that with your guitar. You made the, you brought a lot of love to a whole lot of people.
You giving me so many compliments, I'm gonna jump and start hollering.
No, I'm just telling the truth, man. You're giving love to me and a whole bunch of other folk for many, many years.
I'm happy.
Your mother dies and you're 9 and a half. So where do you go at 9 and a half? Who raised you?
Well, I had quite a few relatives. I had one close relative, my uncle,
right,
my mother's brother. So I stayed with him a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't know, my mother and my dad was divorced or in a country like Mississippi where they was not together.
Right.
They used to call it separated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that has happened to me.
Yeah.
I got the seed.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the first time you saw a guitar being played in a black church. I'll come to that in just a second. But while we're talking about this, how you mentioned a moment ago how different your life might be had your mother lived, that you might not have ever played guitar because you loved your mama like most black men. You wanted to make your mama proud.
I did.
And if mama don't want you to play guitar, you might have done something else.
No, I wouldn't have done any. Yeah. I wouldn't have played guitar.
You wouldn't play guitar, exactly. That's what I'm saying. You might have done something else had your mother lived.
True.
So the question is, how different do you think your life would be if you hadn't grown up in Mississippi?
She wouldn't have had grandchildren early.
Yeah. you're in rare form. In rare form. All because you grew up in Mississippi, I see, with them pretty girls running around.
Oh, they have a lot of beautiful ones.
I know they do, then and now. let me go.
Are you married?
Not yet. I'm not yet. I'm right behind you. I'm right behind you.
Okay.
All right. Let me go from pretty girls to the church, which is an interesting segue, although there are a lot of pretty girls in the church.
That's one thing I can think of. She really wanted me. I used to sing in a quartet, and she liked that. And she also...
were you singing gospel or other
gospel?
Stuff? Gospel. I know. That's why she liked it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Gospel quartet.
Yeah.
So you were singing gospel quartet years ago. Your mama liked that. The first time I'm told from that you saw a guitar being played was in
the
a church.
Preacher. The pastor in church.
Tell me about it.
Reverend Archie Fair.
Uh huh.
I wanted to be like him. He was a. We belong to what we call the sanctified faith.
Mm-hmm.
And
same
he
for me.
Was a preacher.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be just like him. And people used to tell me when I was younger that I played a lot like him and was ugly like him.
No, they didn't say that. They didn't say that.
Yes, they did.
No.
I tried my best to make myself look a little better. Didn't work.
did you? So you first see a guitar being played in church, but did you first start playing in church?
Not really.
I didn't think
my
so,
uncle's
yeah.
house.
At your uncle's house, yeah, yeah.
My uncle, he was like a young baby when he was around my mother.
Uh-huh.
And he was the oldest.
Right.
But if she said something and a tear fall over here, he'd do exactly what she said.
Oh, yeah.
And I was a little different. She had to get my dad's razor strap.
To get you to do anything.
A little tear.
Yeah. So you started playing at your uncle's. When did you get your first guitar?
I started living with a family called the Cottage family.
Uh-huh.
And I had seen a guy, a white person, that had a guitar, and he wanted to sell it. And I offered all kind of habits of chores or whatever, if they would get me one.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted $5 for it. So
you did chores to get it?
Yes.
You wanted that guitar bad?
Really bad.
Yeah.
Because my uncle used to call me lazy.
Yeah. Your uncle called you lazy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's dead, so he can't hear you.
Yeah.
No, I don't think.
But when you got that guitar, though, you went to work. So you are famously, as we know, self-taught.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm self-taught.
Yeah.
But I finally learned that they was having little shows of night dances, or whatever you call them, at little juke joints.
Right.
Not far from where I lived, and I used to go there.
Right.
And they wouldn't let me play inside, but I could sit outside when it was on the weekends when it wasn't raining or something.
So you listened to what was going on inside?
Yes.
And you started picking stuff up?
Jukebox, yeah.
Yep. Wow. Mm-hmm. So when did the Memphis move come in? When did you make your way up to Memphis?
Much later than that. Yeah. Let's see. I can't remember the exact, but it was in the 50s, early 50s.
Right. But you went to Memphis, why specifically?
They had better places you could play, and right. they'd let people in my age.
Right.
And sometimes the proprietors of the little juke joints gave me a couple of dollars.
Right.
And I loved that. I'd go back next Saturday.
Yeah. So how in your own words then, even though you're from Mississippi, how does Memphis play into the success of B.B. King? How does that fit in?
Plays in all of it. I ran into a guy called Rufus Thomas.
Oh, Lord, yes.
You heard of him?
Stacks Records, Rufus Thomas. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Rufus Thomas, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what had happened, I would go to what they called the amateur show.
Right.
And Rufus Thomas was the MC.
Mm-hmm.
So he did hear my crying and whining and everything trying to get on.
Uh-huh.
So he would let me on, even though I maybe was on last week.
Uh-huh.
But he looked at me, and I guess I looked so pitiful, he said, "Bill, you was just on last week." I said, "Yeah, but I ain't got no money."
Yeah.
See, if you went on, you got a dollar.
Right.
And if you won, you got five.
Right.
I never did get the five.
What did you make of the fact that those other guys who won the five may have been pretty good, but years later, you end up being the king of the blues?
Well, I've never said that.
I know, but I said it. I said it, and everybody who knows how good you are said, you are the king of the blues.
All right,
but you never won the $5 night?
Never did. Never did.
You still mad about that?
No, I ain't.
You finally got over it?
I talked about him, though, when I got proper. Yeah, I call him dirty names.
Yeah.
He was one of my best friends.
When did you know, I'm not talking about what other people said, when did you know that you were really, really good at this guitar?
A record company from L.A.
Right.
Started to record me. And you know what they paid me per side?
What?
2 cents.
Come on.
I'm not lying to
you. 2 cents?
2 cents per side a record, you know.
So you got four cents per record?
Yeah.
Come on, B.B. King.
Very glad to get it.
Mm-hmm. 4 cents?
Yes. And before, well, I don't do much recording anymore, but before I really stopped, I was glad to get five. 5 cents a record. That's why when I see people today and they complain about what they get, and I pick cotton for $2 and half a day.
Mm-hmm.
But my cousin and I could pick 1,000 pounds a day. So like that, we could stay and rest in the bed until everybody else was gone to the fields. And then he would say, "You better come on out here, because if we didn't go to fields with the other people,
mm-hmm.
we'd get bawled at, you know. But
mm-hmm.
If we went later than the rest of the family and picked, I was averaging about 400 pounds a day, and my cousin played, he picked more.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, something is, as I listen to you tell this story, something is wrong about you making more money picking cotton than playing your guitar.
Then, yeah.
Something's wrong with that, though. that don't sound right, B.B. King.
Yeah, all right.
I know the facts are right. I'm just saying it just ain't fair. It ain't right make more for picking cotton than playing your guitar.
Not later.
Yeah,
that
I know, I know, I know, I know, I know.
That was the beginning. The beginning, I thought it was good, though.
Yeah. It what? Playing the guitar or picking cotton?
Picking cotton.
Oh, yeah. And then you start picking your guitar.
Yeah.
How did, and I know there's no simple answer to this, but if you really want to have if you really want to get a real appreciation of B.B. King, you talk to Buddy Guy. I've been so fortunate over the years, spent a lot of time with him. And every time I talk to Buddy Guy, I'm trying to talk about Buddy Guy.
And he's bringing up
all he wants to talk about is B.B. King. It happens every time. Every time I talk to Buddy Guy, all he wants to talk about is B.B. King. And he talks about the fact that he learned so much from the licks that you play. How did you establish that signature B.B. King sound?
To be honest with you, I don't know.
You don't? Yeah.
No, I don't know, but I. It just seemed to me that the way I played was nice. Yeah. I could hear myself. And I don't know, I always thought that Buddy Guy was really good, still is.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of other young players around at that time when I was coming, but there was older people like Blind Lemon, which was one of my favorites, and I don't know, it just seemed like everybody I heard could play better than me, and I was there with my... You ever see, I don't mean to give them a plug, but RCA, they had a trademark that was on the record players. And it was a little dog listening to the records as they play. And the signal was that the records were so good, so clear, that the dog could understand who it was. And that was me.
That was you listening all the time.
Yeah. No, I...
See, I think you're too modest, and Buddy Guy says about you all the time, that you're too modest. You created a signature sound that everybody then and now wants to emulate, and you don't even know how you did it.
No, I don't.
Well, we ain't going to mess with it then. It works, and if you don't want to mess with it, I ain't going
to
mess with it.
No, that sounds good to me, because that's the way my preacher played in church.
Right.
Not exactly like I am, like I was, because... Naturally, I didn't play blues in church, but I felt like it.
did you ever have, there are so many players, and again, you didn't start playing in the church, but your mother loved you singing quartet. There are so many players in the black community that come out of the church.
Yes.
Did you ever have any point in your life where you were wrestling with whether you wanted to play in the church, whether you wanted to play the blues?
I had to play in the church when I started trying to play.
Right.
That was the only way I could play.
Right.
You don't know my mother, boy. She was kind of...
She didn't play, though.
Oh, she was with a strap or something? Oh, she could beat you nicely.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that.
Beat you nicely. That sounds oxymoronic, but I take it. She could beat you nicely.
I don't know what that means.
You can't beat nobody nicely, but I take your point. I know what you're trying to say.
Yeah,
I get it.
Yeah,
that's what I love about the blues. If you listen, you know what they're trying to say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what the blues are saying. So I talked about the lynching that you saw and how that impacted you as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about the time the stint you had in the Army. You spent some time in the Army.
Just a short time.
Yeah, but tell me tell me what you did and how that impacted your life, being in the Army.
Well, I am... Well, first, let me tell you a little story.
Please.
When we went into World War II, I was a tractor driver then. I drove tractors on the plantation. And so when they start calling people my age, 18 up, I was one to call. And I went to Camp Shelby. Camp Shelby is right outside of, not far from Jackson, Mississippi. And I already knew how to drive tractor. I was pretty good with that. So they would give me a job driving tractor, which was like I wasn't in nothing special, because I've been doing that all the time.
Right.
And I kind of liked that, but they reclassified us. I said us because it was several of us, about 80 of us that went in at the same time. And scared me about half to death on the bus. Because we was on the Greyhound buses going to, I'm giving somebody else a plug, going to Camp Shelby, it was called. And two or three of the guys wasn't from Mississippi that went down with them. They were picking with the girls, white girls, on the side of the road picking cotton. I went in the back of the bus. If I had been riding bus for pay, I still would have to sit in the back. But I got through it pretty good, because I had a lot of older friends around me that had taught me about working for white people.
So when you got in the Army, you knew how to behave, in other words?
Yes, sir.
And you got in and you got out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fine. No problem.
I suspect we'll get to talk more about this tomorrow night, but let me just put this question out now. There's a movie that I love. I see it all the time. It's always on cable, called Cadillac Records. Mm-hmm. And it talks, of course, about all the artists and how they got ripped off so bad back mm-hmm. in the day.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah. In fact, I have it.
Yeah. What's your worst horror story about getting ripped off over the years as an artist?
I don't think I knew about getting ripped off at the time. Because, hey, I'm recording. Mm-hmm. I don't care how much money it was, but I was recording, and I thought, being a recording artist, girls.
Yeah. If I'm recording, I'm getting the girls, and the money will take care of itself.
Yeah.
But at some point, though, you came to understand, though, that you can't survive without money.
I did finally understand a little bit, and some of the guys that had ripped me off was helping me out.
Explain that. They were ripping you off and helping you out?
After I had left them.
Right.
They was showing me that. Playing pretty good then, and I should come back to them because they would give me a dime, maybe even a quarter. And I then went to one of the larger companies.
Right.
And here I am.
Yeah.
I can work for you now. And
get out of here, please. I can come work for you. I will come carry Lucille. All and off the bus, all and off the stage, anytime you want me.
I got some guys around here who wouldn't like that.
So. Yeah. I don't want to take nobody's job from the brothers who are here work with you. Join me next time as we wrap up our conversation with the King of the Blues, B.B. King.
Thrill is gone. Thrill is gone. Thrill is gone, baby. Thrill is gone away. You done me wrong, baby. We'll be sorry someday. Thrill is gone. Thrill is gone away from me. Thrill is gone. Thrill is gone away from me. Oh, no, I'm still living on, but so lonely.
B.B. King, one of the greatest blues men the world has ever known, dead at the age of 89.